start out and tell us what was the motivation in putting together your new book, Armed Madhouse?
Because I'm blacked out, man. I'm blacked out off the nation's airways, except for the crack in the electronic Berlin Wall, the Mike McCormick. You know, it's no joke. I just saw another paper in Asia Week, saying, you know, Greg Palast, recognized as the top investigative reporter in the United States, is persona non grata in America's own newsrooms. My reports would drown trying to get across from the BBC, so I have to put them in a book form, and until Patriot Act 4, they can't block the books.
And yet your last book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, was like a bestseller.
It was indeed on the New York Times bestseller list nearly a year without one single daily newspaper review or magazine review from the mainstream. Not one. I didn't exist. They pretended I would go away, and I'm back.
So I did actually see that you made it through a small crack here in Seattle. The one of our local two daily papers.
That's right.
Seattle PI had one of your op-eds.
The Seattle PI had one of my op-eds. In fact, that was the second one that they've run. The first one was an award winner, and I think they were surprised to find that they were alone. I have to grant that the Seattle PI wrote a story, which I co-authored with Jesse Jackson, about a million black votes not counted in the 2004 election, and which we go into deeper in the book in the section Our Madhouse, for which the Seattle PI, and this is a first, won a Project Censored Award for stories that of national significance that the rest of the press completely ignored. So that's a first for the Seattle PI, I have to say. You know, so they dipped their toes into wild waters. You know, so, but on the other hand, I don't know how often they'll do that. I got to tell you, they just got banged by one of the big power companies for me writing that Ken Lay's co-conspirators remain unindicted. I didn't give the full force of it because there's only so much I can put in your daily paper. But, you know, justice was not done in the Ken Lay case, and we are left with his Rosemary's Baby, that little bastard called electricity deregulation.
We'll talk about that a little more because we just see in the corporate media that Ken Lay and Jeffrey Skilling appear to have had their day in court. Do you expect them to ever really serve any time? And talk about a bit.
Oh, I think
they
will. They're going to. They need someone to walk the plank. But here's the deal: the co-conspirators were breaking out the champagne. Let's not forget, as the Wall Street Journal pointed out, it was a very limited indictment. For a damn good reason, which is that the big crimes of Ken Lay were not failing what he was convicted of, which is not filing the proper SEC and bank forms. You know, that's like Capone going up the river for not filing his taxes. His big crime was ripping off the California power market for $9 billion, and he didn't do that alone. His co-conspirators were six other power companies. Okay, six other power companies. A half dozen investment banks, a big giant law firm, and a couple politicians named Dick and Arnie, who would have to be called to the stand if not charged. You have to remember that Arnold Schwarzenegger had a secret meeting with Ken Lay in May 21, 2001. You'll get this in the book in the section called When Arnold Got Laid. Anyone reading Our Madhouse will be stuck with, of course, with so, while my better journalism, they're going to have to read my worst jokes. And when Arnold got laid, it was when Arnie met with Ken Lay in Beverly Hills, in the Beverly Hills Hotel. Lay was saying, we need a state of California government that's going to sign off on deals with us, basically sweetheart deals, and withdraw their lawsuits and complaints demanding we give back the money. Because that's the one thing that they fear more than jail time, is giving back the money. Right after that meeting, a recall campaign against the governor of California begins. Arnie the Terminator becomes the governor and immediately signs off on all the sweetheart deals that Ken Lay had proposed. Now, was there an illegal agreement between them? I make you governor, you make me bulletproof from lawsuits, and I get to keep my billions. Or maybe there wasn't a deal. It just happened to be a miraculous coincidence. either way, a real indictment, a real trial, would have brought Arnie's behind right into the courtroom to answer those questions. And that ain't going to happen. So in other words, Lay is going to serve time, no question, in my opinion. But Schwarzenegger won't. The heads of Reliant Energy, Entergy, Duke Power, all these characters who conspired with Ken Lay and Enron, they're off the hook. You know, so, you know, one gangster goes down and the gang remains in power.
So as citizens, we can't really expect any real changes to come about from this then, any systemic changes?
There will be systemic changes. You got to keep fighting. It's slowed down this so-called deregulation, which is basically decriminalization of price gouging. I mean, there is another story in the book called Blackout, Traced to Dim Bulb in White House. And it's about them taking apart the protections that stop marauders like Ken Lay. And they have taken apart most of those protections, but it will come back. America's been through this before. I mean, I write about everything from oil wars to stolen elections to, you know, class war entering the classroom. We'll beat these guys. Like any bullies, they're cowards.
Oil and following the money seem to be fairly reoccurring themes in mm-hmm. both your investigations and in your book. Mm-hmm. And there are those that in the corporate media that have accused the White House of not having a plan for post-invasion Iraq. And you take the entirely opposite view of that.
Well, they had a plan. They had two plans. And, yeah, I mean, the American press, well, it looks like they goofed up because they didn't have a plan. No. The problem was they had two plans, and I've got them both. I show you the key parts of each page. And the plans, by the way, they didn't goof up at all. The number one plan was to put Iraq back into the good graces of OPEC, make sure that Iraq would maintain its OPEC oil quota and not flood the market with oil, and it certainly hasn't. Between George Bush and Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, they've done a very good job, hand-in-hand, of maintaining Saudi Arabian control of OPEC and the price of oil. George Bush came into office, oil was $18 to $20 a barrel he inherited from Bill Clinton. It's now over $70 a barrel. That's mission accomplished. You have to look at the plan. They didn't fail to have a plan. Unfortunately, they did have one. The other plan, which was a bit different, was created by neocons out of Washington. That's 101 pages long, and I show that in the book, too. And that plan, the shadow crafter behind that plan was a guy named Grover Norquist, you know, the ultimate corporate lobbyist, the number one right-wing lobbyist in Washington. You know, works with the Christian Coalition, the NRA, Microsoft, Sony, American Express. And he wrote up the plans. He literally, these corporate lobbyists and their operators basically directed the writing of the occupation plans, which led to the sale of the banks in Iraq, which led to weird things like we changed the copyright laws of Iraq by fiat to make sure that Microsoft, that no one could, you know, do bootleg copies of Microsoft Word. And this is what was attached to the invasion plan. We had 100 orders issued by Paul Bremer, the Pasha we put in charge there. And basically, these were just implementing a wish list of corporate lobbyist gimmies. That was the second plan. So they had plans. But talking to Iraqis who basically were on the inside of this, they said one of the problems with these plans is that's one of the reasons there's an insurgency. Jay Garner, the first general we put in there, I spoke with him. And I said, do you recognize these plans? I showed him the Norquist lobbyist plan for Iraq. He said, yeah, I saw that. And I said, so why didn't you implement it? Why did it have to wait for Paul Bremer? He says, I wasn't going to impose this plan on the Iraqis. It's their country. It's their oil. And that was his mistake. The day he arrived in Baghdad, he told Rumsfeld to stick his lobbyist-written occupation plans where the sun don't shine, okay? And Rumsfeld's response was, you're fired, the day he arrived in Baghdad, and put in instead the managing director of Henry Kissinger Associates, Paul Bremer, in to do the deed. So it's mission accomplished. They haven't screwed up here at all. This is exactly what they had in mind, exactly.
And it was interesting, the selection of Bremer, since he didn't really appear to have any experience.
He had experience. No. Look, Jay Garner had experience. He had run the northern zone of Iraq. He lived in Iraq for like 4 years. He knew the people. They knew him. But that's not the experience these guys were looking at. They weren't trying to win a popularity contest in Iraq. They were occupying and trying to squeeze Iraq for what they could get. And Garner had the wrong experience. Garner thought we were supposed to, like, bring, you know, he actually somehow believed, you should listen to this guy, he actually kind of thought, well, you know, we'll bring democracy, and he called for elections. They said, no elections, man. No elections until things are taken care of, meaning the control of the oil fields, et cetera. And so Garner wanted to have elections within 90 days, so they fired him. Then they brought in Bremer, who delayed the elections for 2 years until we had a nice cooking insurgency, because you can't have a war. Remember what happened to Bush 1. He won, as Karl Rove once said, Bush 1 won the war too quickly. He won Gulf War 1 in 100 hours and got demolished 1 year later in the elections. Bush 2 wasn't going to let that happen. Bring him on. You can't be a war president without a war. This is the program, and he did get reelected. I don't see why people think he goofed up. Oil at $70 a barrel, a war president with a war, Republican control of both houses of Congress and the judiciary. Mission accomplished.
So what do you think is going to happen in Iraq?
You know, I'm not a very good prognosticator. I'm an investigator as to what has happened. We know this. Whatever else happens on the ground, whether the Sunnis are slaughtering the Shiites or Shiites are slaughtering the Sunnis, this will happen. OPEC, which is the oil cartel run by Saudi Arabia, will still maintain shadow control over Iraq and its oil fields. That Iraq will never get out of line and threaten the power of Saudi Arabia. That's the number one concern. That is the number one concern, that Iraq, which has nearly as much oil as Saudi Arabia, guys, will drill the oil. You know, I know a lot of my good-hearted friends were, you know, screaming, no blood for oil. No blood for oil. But, you know, most Americans think blood for oil, that's a bargain. But that's not why we went in there. We didn't go in there to get the oil. We went in there to not get the oil. That's the weirdest thing that I found in my investigations, to make sure that we didn't get the oil. Because if you went in and got the oil, oil would be back down to $9 a barrel, where it was, you know, just 15 years ago. $18 a barrel just 6 years ago. Now it's $70 a barrel. Do you think the oil companies find that a problem? Oil companies aren't looking for oil. Oil companies are looking for ways to, they're hunting around the world to turn off oil spigots to keep up the price. ExxonMobil's earning $10 billion clear freaking profit every 3 months. No one's made that much money since the Pharaohs.
You like to challenge a lot of ideas that get picked up in the alternative media.
In and any media.
That's...
I mean, not just the alternative. You know, I mean, I'm not allowed... I'm not liked anywhere. And as soon as I am, I'm in trouble. I quit. Go ahead.
And one of the things that you poke fun at in your book is the people that are supporting the peak oil concept. Can you talk about that?
I mean, look, who came up with peak oil, guys? Peak oil was denounced by a guy named Hubbert, who is the chief oil geologist for Shell Oil Company. Now, why would an oil company... Now, here you go. Here's a test for you, Mike. TikTok, you got 3 seconds to answer. Why would an oil company say we're running out of oil? Your time's up, because the less of a product, the higher its price. We're running out. You're paying $3 a gallon because we're running out of oil. I mean, I hear the peak freaks out there say, oh, my God, do you realize that oil is $70 a barrel? That means that we have none. How about the fact that we're bombing the pipelines? How about the fact that we sabotaged the biggest importer, once the biggest importer to the U.S., Venezuela, we've sabotaged their oil system and the flow of their pipes, literally physically sabotaged it. Putin knocking out the number one driller in Russia. We've squeezed the system. We suddenly didn't run out. We were awash in oil. They didn't even know what to do with it when Bill Clinton left office. It was cheaper than peanut butter, and these guys didn't like it. We hadn't suddenly run out of oil, so forget it. But though I have to say, I'm not going to knock the guy Hubbert, because if you actually read his 1956 paper, 50 years ago this month, by the way, 56 years ago this month, we are what we're running into is a change, as he said, from one type of oil to another, from light oil to heavy oil. And that's why I have a chapter called The Assassination of Hugo Chavez, because where is the heavy oil? Where is the new oil? The new oil, is not in Saudi Arabia. The biggest oil reserves on the planet are not in the Mideast, but under Venezuela, under Hugo Chavez. And that's why they got to get him, because he could release that oil. And that they really don't want that.
Last night when I was going through your book, it suddenly dawned on me why the once the price of a barrel of oil crosses a certain point, and I think you put it at around $50 a barrel, that the whole oil game suddenly shifts. Places like Venezuela and Canada all of a sudden become major players.
Yeah, okay. In fact, tomorrow, Hugo Chavez hosts, the beginning of June, Hugo Chavez hosts the meeting of OPEC, of the oil cartel, in Caracas. And at that meeting, he's going to demand that the cartel recognize that Venezuela, not Saudi Arabia, has the largest oil reserve. Because when the price of oil goes up really above $30 a barrel. And that, by the way, I got, you look in our madhouse, you'll see page 184, for those taking careful notes, that there's a chart from inside the Department of Energy, which they wish you don't, that you wouldn't see, showing that Venezuela, not Saudi Arabia, has the largest reserves of oil by far. But, you know, it's in the form of heavy oil, which when the price of oil is $9 a barrel, no one's going to pull that gunk up because it's like liquid asphalt. But once the price rises, the whole game changes. So it's a very tough game for Saudi Arabia. They can only let the price of oil stay up so long before they have to deliberately make it crash, which they will do.
And do you anticipate OPEC is going to go along with Hugo Chavez?
I called Riyadh, and I called the Saudis. The answer is no. The big war on this planet is between Saudi Arabia and Venezuela, and all George Bush is their toy in the game. You know, the Saudi Arabian army marching song is Onward Christian Soldiers. So, I mean, you know, Bush is... Look, the Saudi Arabians, and this is very important, lend us billions of dollars, maybe up to $1 trillion by this point, in petrodollars. How do you think George Bush funds his oil wars and his tax cuts for the rich? You know, we don't get taxed directly. We get taxed at the pump. And the Saudi Arabians return that money in the form of petrodollars. They buy treasury bills and treasury bonds, etc. So that's funding George Bush's deficit. But they lend us their petrodollars, and we lend them the 82nd Airborne. And that's how it works. Now, are they going to let some berserker in Venezuela upset the game? I don't think so, because, you know, Chavez has said, I'm not giving you petrodollars. I'll give you cheap oil. I'll give you oil cheaper. He told me last month, I met with President Chavez last month. He said, I'll give you cheaper oil than Saudi Arabia. But what I won't do is give you back the money. We're going to keep it in Venezuela and Latin America to build this place. And we're going to wipe out, we're going to abolish the IMF. This guy has big cojones, man. And he started doing it. He withdrew $20 billion from the U.S. Federal Reserve, gave it to Argentina, which then told the IMF to go fly. I mean, that's why, you'll see in the book, I quote Pat Robertson, Hugo Chavez thinks we're trying to assassinate him, and I think we should just go ahead and do it. And that's the future. So I think that there is going to be a very subtle battle between the Saudis and Venezuela, and it's not going to be public, because that's not understood by our press. They will never understand it. They do not understand how oil works.
Who's your money on in this particular battle?
In the short term? In the short term, you cannot beat the power of big oil in Saudi Arabia. They, at the moment, have the capital, because the Saudis can always... Remember what the Saudis can do, which is why Chavez has to be careful. The Saudis can punish, just like they punished the Soviet Union for invading Afghanistan. Who brought down the Soviet Union? It wasn't that senile grandpa that we had in the White House. The goofy idea that somehow the Soviet Union collapsed because Ronald Reagan grinned at them and had Star Wars, like, they, oh my God, we better give up communism. You know, I mean, what the heck? You know, it was like goofy. The Saudi Arabians opened up their oil spigots and dropped the price of oil to $9 a barrel and bankrupted the Soviet Union. It was, you know, just simply put it out of business. And they could do the same to Chavez in Venezuela. So he's got to be careful. Besides, there's another way to take care of Chavez. Like I say, the bullet method. And in 2002, they kidnapped the guy. You know, I write about that too in the network section. And, you know, and they don't like Chavez anyway, because unlike Abdullah and George Bush, you know, Hugo Chavez was elected.
Well, speaking of elections, you really rocketed to fame here, at least amongst the alternative press, when you had come out with your investigation into the Florida elections in 2000.
That's right.
You've been obviously following all this for quite a while now. Do you see us as any better off, or things getting worse with the 2006 and 2008 elections on the
way? Well, in 2000, for those who don't know, very quickly, I uncovered for BBC television, I discovered that Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush, just before the 2000 election, had scrubbed tens of thousands of black voters off the voter rolls of Florida. Just wiped them out. Accused them of being felons, and their only crime was voting while black. You know, and that's what gave little George the White House. I mean, and you could not get that into the U.S. press. Forget it. It was a forbidden topic. Now, 2004, they did it again, but it was much more sophisticated, much more widespread. And people even only looked at Ohio, where it was gross and raw, not looking at places like New Mexico and Iowa, which supposedly Bush won. He didn't. The 2004 election made the theft of 2000, you know, just look like Girl Scouts next to the mob. This was big, and it's getting worse. So that I have a chapter in the book called Kerry Won, Now Get Over It, because they're putting 2008 in their pocket and 2006. 3.6 million votes were cast, Mike, in the last election, 2004. 3.6 million votes, ballots were cast and not counted. And that isn't Greg Palast helicopter stuff, black helicopters dropping this stuff on me. Dig into the files, the Election Information Administration, and dig into the U.S. Census Bureau's files and the state-by-state files, and what you find is that America has a very interesting way of handling votes. We only count the ones we want to count. It's a lot of votes, but it's easy to cover because there's 100 million votes cast. And those 3%, 3 to 4% is just looked at as what they call spoilage, you know, just kind of errors, you know, hanging chads, mangled ballots. Computers just didn't record a vote. And they had a whole crew of what's called provisional ballots this time. But it's not just anyone that loses their vote. If you're in a black majority precinct, the chance you're going to lose your vote is 900% higher than if you're in a white majority precinct. If you're black, they don't count your vote. If you're Native American, one thing I have in the story that's affected huge elections in the West, there are Native American precincts that where the machines show that only 1 in 10 Natives chose a president. I went out to the reservation to find these all these indecisive Indians who, by the way, you know, according to the machines, actually showed up, voted, but they didn't pick a president. Didn't pick a president. And I want to find out why they couldn't make up their minds. There's some big guys there in ponytails who said, "Listen, white boy, let us explain. We pick presidents, but we don't pick the voting machines that are brought to us. They don't give us blankets with smallpox anymore. They give us baloney voting machines that don't register our vote. You can shoot an arrow as far as you want in the Native reservation, you won't find a Republican. They know who they're giving those machines to. They know whose votes aren't counted. This is how they shoplifted 2004. And 2006, databases are very important, by the way, to this theft, because it's all done by statistics and other little games. The database gathering for the war on terror, the database gathering for the war on immigrants, that's all about preparing to make sure that the people don't make the wrong choice when they vote.
You mentioned Catherine Harris, who had figured prominently into your first book. Were you surprised and shocked with the recent allegations of her accepting illegal contributions?
I'm shocked. You know what's funny about that? The Republicans decided that she had to go. They did a hit on her. You know, they did a hit on her. Who else has taken illegal contributions named Bush? You know, there's some pretty stinky contributions going on out there, but the Republican Party decided that she got out of line. They did a hit on their own henchmen. And so, no, I'm not surprised. I just find the great humor in finally coming together. I mean, you have to understand, these secretaries of state, you know, if you're looking at one, this is the problem. Again, it's the unindicted ones. People look to a rare case in which you'll nail one or two without looking at why they sacrificed that one. And that's the story here. I mean, you have to look at, you know, for example, I was looking at New Mexico, where the vote, where supposedly George Bush won by 5,000 votes, yet there were 30,000 ballots that were never counted. Why not count those? And golly gee, they're almost all out of Hispanic and Native American precincts. Now, whose votes are those? We know whose votes those are. We know. 89%, dig this, 89% of the votes never cast, not counted in New Mexico, come from minority precincts. So we know who won New Mexico. And why weren't the votes counted? Well, let's go back to the question of contracts. Secretary of State, who was her big funders? Some of these voting machine companies that came up with the cracked votes. Who did she hire to investigate what went wrong with the vote? The executives of the voting machine companies that donated to her and gave her the bad voting machines. It's a nice little circle. Now you'll see, there's some fun stuff in here. I mean, as funny as a stolen election could be, it's pretty funny. There's a lot of dark humor. It's the only way I can get through it. You know, it's so grim that if you didn't laugh, you'd be on your knees in tears every day.
So, unfortunately, a half hour isn't really enough to do anything but scratch the surface on your book and what you've been working on. But luckily, you are coming to Seattle on June 8th.
On June 8th at Town Hall, 7:30 p.m., we'll be having kind of a Arm Madhouse boot camp for those, you know, the entire title of the book. I got to take a breath. Armed Madhouse, Who's Afraid of Osama Wolf, China Floats, Bush Sinks, The Scheme to Steal 08, No Child Behind Left, and Other Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Class War. That's the key thing, Armed Madhouse and the Class War, because this will be the Armed Madhouse Class War Boot Camp, where we're going to go from everything from the War on Terror, you know, the Osama follies, to shoplifting elections, to class war in the classroom. So, you know, come and be prepared for Class War Boot Camp in Town Hall on Thursday, which is June 8th.
Well, if it's a boot camp, then I guess Homeland Security will be there as well.
They're with us right now. Hi, guys.
All right. Well, Greg, I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thanks a lot. Great. Bye.